Today is Wednesday, March 26th, 2025, and you're listening to the World Socialist Website. How American Imperialism Plots Wars of Aggression, by Andre Damon. On March 15th, the U.S. military launched airstrikes on residential neighborhoods in Sana'a, the capital of Yemen, killing 53 men, women, and children. Among the targets were political leaders of the Houthi government. Yemen, the poorest country in the Middle East, has endured years of U.S.-backed bombings and deliberate starvation at the hands of Saudi Arabia, resulting in the deaths of more than 400,000 people. The U.S. airstrikes violated multiple statutes and treaties under international law, rendering those who planned, perpetrated, and executed the attack guilty of the following war crimes: launching an unprovoked attack in violation of the prohibition on the use of force under the UN Charter and the Rome Statute, targeting and killing political leaders who are not engaged in combat, in violation of the protections of the UN Charter, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the ICCPR, and the Rome Statute. Employing weapons or tactics that fail to distinguish between military and civilian targets, in violation of the prohibition on indiscriminate attacks as outlined in the Geneva Conventions and the Rome Statute. On Monday, 10 days after the U.S. military launched the attacks on Yemen, The Atlantic magazine published a report revealing the fact that leading officials in the Trump administration had accidentally included Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor-in-chief of the magazine, in a message thread in which they plotted the attack on Yemen. Goldberg, having found himself privy to a criminal conspiracy to launch an illegal war of aggression, dutifully removed himself from the message thread, notified the conspirators of their mistake, and then waited 10 days before publishing selected excerpts from the discussion. The accidental inclusion of Goldberg in the war plans provoked outrage from the Democratic Party and the media, not over the criminal war of aggression or the war crimes being planned, but because the discussion took place outside secure military channels. House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries called on Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth to resign, claiming his actions shocked the conscience and likely violated the law, not for murdering civilians, but for inadvertently exposing these crimes to the public. But what is of interest to the public is not the channel through which the conspiracy was discussed, but its contents. The leaked discussion offers a revealing glimpse into how American wars of aggression are prepared, launched, and fraudulently justified. Though Trump officials may have used a different communications platform, the content mirrors the planning and deceit behind countless wars launched by previous administrations. The thread on the Signal app documented a discussion among senior members of the Trump administration regarding the timing and advisability of launching a new campaign against Yemen. While Vice President J.D. Vance argued for a delay, Trump, via his fascist-minded advisor, Stephen Miller, ultimately decided to launch the strikes immediately. The discussion made clear that the attack on a small, poor, and defenseless nation was purely a war of choice, intended to signal to the world that the United States remains the dominant global military power. As Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth explained in the message thread, this is not about the Houthis, that is, the nominal target of the attack. Rather, it was aimed at, quote, restoring freedom of navigation and reestablishing deterrence. The public justification for the attack on Yemen was the statement by Yemen's Houthi government that it would block Israeli ships from transiting the Red Sea unless Israel stopped blocking food from entering Gaza. The very prospect of this defiance of Israel, the United States proxy in the Middle East, was seen as challenging American imperialism. It had to be met with overwhelming violence to send a message to the rest of the world and, in Hegseth's words, re-establish deterrence. Each of the hundreds of wars, military operations, and destabilization campaigns carried out by the United States since the U.S. emerged as an imperialist power has been justified to the public as a response to an imminent threat. Unless the U.S. military takes action, people will die, the public has been told over and over. But the exchange on the attack on Yemen made clear that no such imminent threat existed. In the exchange, Joe Kent, Trump's nominee to head the National Counterterrorism Center, wrote, "There's nothing time-sensitive driving the timeline. We'll have the same options in a month." Hegseth added, "Waiting a few weeks or a month does not fundamentally change the calculus." The most pressing question raised by the Trump administration's exposed war plans against Yemen is, what other wars of choice is the administration currently preparing? Multiple participants in the discussion of the attack on Yemen made clear in previous statements that the central target of U.S. military aggression is China. In the words of Hegseth, China is the only country in the world with the capabilities and intent to threaten our core national interest. End quote. Earlier this month, Elon Musk, the world's richest man and CEO of leading military contractor SpaceX, traveled to the Pentagon to attend a classified briefing on U.S. war plans against China, including specific targets for attack. In the end, the meeting was reportedly canceled after news of it leaked to the press. But the very fact that such a meeting was scheduled to take place raises the question, does the Trump administration have a timetable for war with China, the country with the world's largest population, economy, and third largest nuclear arsenal? In January 2023, four-star General Mike Minahan, head of the Air Force's Air Mobility Command, issued an internal memo predicting a U.S.-China war by 2025. He wrote that, quote, "Chinese Premier Xi's team, reason, and opportunity are all aligned for 2025, and urged troops to, quote, consider their personal affairs and practice by firing at a 7-meter target, emphasizing that unrepentant lethality matters most. Aim for the head." End quote. In the discussion about the attack on Yemen, a major concern raised by Vance was that, quote, "the public doesn't understand this or why it's necessary." This is undoubtedly a central issue in the Trump administration's war planning against China. How can the American people be made to accept a war on the other side of the world, one that would involve, at minimum, the deaths of a vast number of U.S. troops and the expenditure of hundreds of billions of dollars and, at worst, the nuclear annihilation of major American cities? The current issue of Foreign Affairs raises this very question in an article titled, "Would Americans Go to War Against China?" The leading journal of U.S. foreign policy argues that while, quote, "most Americans say that they want to pull back from the world," that is, launch fewer wars, public opinion could shift if a war with China were framed as a defensive response to an attack on the United States. The article declares, quote, "but in a survey we conducted in July of ordinary Americans as well as former U.S. policymakers, we found that clear majorities support attacking China if the People's Liberation Army were to hit U.S. ships in the South China Sea." End quote. This line of argument aligns with the views of Elbridge Colby, Trump's nominee for Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. In his 2021 book, The Strategy of Denial, Colby argued that the U.S. must ensure any war with China appears as though Beijing, quote, "fired the first shot." Washington, he wrote, must, quote, "deliberately make China have to strengthen the coalition's resolve," that is, provoke a response that can be used to justify war to the public and U.S. allies. Colby declares, quote, "perhaps the clearest and sometimes the most important way of making sure China is seen this way is simply by ensuring that it is the only one to strike first. Few human moral intuitions are more deeply rooted than that the one who started it is the aggressor, and accordingly, the one who presumptively owns a greater share of moral responsibility. End quote. In other words, in order for the United States to successfully mobilize public support for a war with China, it would have to stage a 21st century version of the 1898 sinking of the USS Maine, used to justify the US seizure of Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines, or the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which was used to justify direct US involvement in the Vietnam War. The leaked discussion of the attack on Yemen must be seen as a warning. The Trump administration, at the head of a predatory and criminal financial oligarchy, beset by political, economic, and social crisis, and confronting mounting domestic opposition, is capable of any crime, including the launching of a full-scale global war of aggression. Judge hears arguments in case brought by Momodou Tal against Trump's executive orders targeting free speech. By the WSWS Live Updates. U.S. District Judge Elizabeth C. Coombe heard arguments from both sides of a landmark lawsuit against two of Trump's executive orders targeting free speech and opposition to the genocide in Gaza on Tuesday. The hearing was held in Syracuse, New York. The case has been brought by Cornell University student Momodou Tal, along with fellow student Sriram Parasurama and Professor Mukomo Wa Ngugi. Attorneys for Tal, Eric Lee, and the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee are also seeking a temporary restraining order, or a TRO, against the Trump administration to prevent it from seizing and deporting Tal in retaliation for bringing the suit, which it is seeking to do. Judge Coombe made no decision either on the main lawsuit or the TRO. A ruling could be made sometime later this week. Hundreds of people attended the hearing or gathered outside the federal courthouse Tuesday afternoon to defend free speech and support Tal. Reporters for the World Socialist website spoke with many of those protesting before and after the hearing. Co-plaintiff Professor Wa Ngugi, "We shouldn't be punishing the people who are calling out what clearly is a genocide." Following the hearing, Professor Mukomo Wa Ngugi, a co-plaintiff with Momodou Tal in the lawsuit against the Trump administration, spoke on the genocide in Gaza and reiterated that Tal is being targeted for simply speaking out against the ongoing massacre. Quote, "I grew up in Kenya, in a dictatorship, and right now I can't tell the difference except that it's colder here. But really, it's certainly about the First Amendment and the right to free expression and to challenge the government and so on and so forth. But I think there's a moral question to it, which is 50,000 dead Palestinians, 800 killed just the other day. It's a genocide. It's a genocide. It's a genocide. We shouldn't be punishing the people who are calling out what clearly is a genocide." End quote. Eric Lee, "If democracy is going to be defended, it's not going to come from the Democratic Party." Speaking outside the courthouse Tuesday after the hearing, Eric Lee, Momodou Tal's lead attorney, emphasized that the fight for democratic rights cannot be waged through the Democratic Party. Tal's lawyer, Eric Lee, "This, quote, is a test case to determine whether the government can put you in jail for the things you say." Following Tuesday's hearing, Eric Lee, Momodou Tal's lead lawyer, issued a powerful statement in front of the courthouse warning that Momodou Tal is a test case to determine whether the government can come to your house and grab you and put you in jail for the things you say, criticizing the United States government and its policies. They start with someone who's a non-citizen. They start with someone who said something that the powers that be find difficult to deal with, that is, calling what Israel is doing to the people of Palestine a genocide. But it doesn't end with Momodou Tal. Next, it will be you. Next, it will be criticizing Donald Trump on social media. that's technically within the bounds of these executive orders. Next, it will be registering people to vote, maybe. That could ultimately come under these orders. We don't know where this ends. We don't know how they will be enforcing them in year 4 of the Trump administration. But we do know, if we stand up and stop them from doing it to Mr. Tal and to the U.S. citizens who have a right to hear views that are critical of the government, then we can stop them from doing it to all of you as well. The judge in the case did not make any rulings during the hearing on Tuesday. Lee said of the proceedings, "We think we made some convincing arguments. We think we're right on the law. We think we're right on the policies. We think we're right on the morals. And we hope that the people that listen and follow this case understand that ultimately our appeal is to you. And that the First Amendment, if it's going to be protected, it's not just going to be protected by the lawyers in the courts. Ultimately, it's going to have to be protected by the American population." End quote. IG Metall Union support conversion of companies like VW to arms production. Volkswagen plans for tanks instead of Tiguan SUVs. By Ludwig Weller. Last week, the parties in the Bundestag, the parliament, agreed to the largest arms deal since the Nazi regime. With 1 trillion euros in play, the management boards of the crisis-ridden industrial conglomerates can smell new profits. This includes Volkswagen, VW. At its annual press conference on March 11th, Europe's largest car maker reported a significant decline in profits for 2024. At the same time, CEO Oliver Blume announced changes for the coming year and confirmed press reports that, quote, "In view of the current world situation, plans are being discussed, quote, to enter the arms business." Germany's largest arms company, Rheinmetall, has recently shown a keen interest in taking over and repurposing VW plants for the production of military vehicles and equipment. At the center of this is the VW plant in Osnabrück, which Rheinmetall boss Armin Papperger has described as very suitable for conversion to military production. The plant, which has so far produced convertibles and small series, could potentially be converted to manufacture military vehicles, such as armored personnel carriers. Rheinmetall is apparently also interested in other VW sites, such as Dresden, according to Auto Motorsport magazine. Recently, there have been increasing reports that various German industrial companies want to start producing military goods. These are both traditional companies and startups, especially so-called defense tech startups, which are sensing the billions in profits to be made from AI-controlled drones and mini-tanks. The IG Metall trade union is a driving force behind this. As early as February 2024, it concluded an armament pact with the Social Democratic Party, the SPD, and the arms industry. A position paper entitled "Securing Sovereignty and Resilience," which was jointly adopted by IG Metall, the SPD's economic forum, and the German Security and Defense Industry Association, BDSV, states, "A comprehensive industrial policy concept for the defense industry does not yet exist. However, such a concept is indispensable to ensure the industry's performance and to enable its possibilities for product development and product production of relevant defense systems in the dimensions of land, air, and sea." End quote. Over 11 pages, it details proposals as to how national and European armaments projects can be made the decisive driving force for Germany as a high-tech production location. Jürgen Kerner, the deputy chairman of IG Metall, who is also a member of the supervisory boards of Airbus, ThyssenKrupp, Siemens, Siemens Energy, MAN Truck and Bus, and Traton, struck a militaristic tone in line with the ruling class, which is once again counting on war. Quote, 2024 is the year of decision for the defense industry in Germany. Although politicians emphasize its importance for the security of our country and Europe, the special fund for the Bundeswehr does not automatically lead to the strengthening of domestic industry, contrary to what one might think. Rather, it is in danger of falling by the wayside when more and more is being purchased overseas, and the government is not ensuring that companies in Germany take on maintenance and upgrades. We finally need a defense industrial policy. End quote. The Bombardier plant in Görlitz, taken over by Alstom in 2021, has already been sold to the arms company KNDS. The more than 170 years of continuous production of wagons and rail vehicles will be discontinued. Instead, military equipment for the war in Ukraine will soon be produced there. The well-known Cologne-based engine manufacturer, Dutz, also wants to enter the arms business. Engines for wheeled armored vehicles promise higher profits than agricultural machinery. The Meyer shipyard in Papenburg, which has built huge cruise liners so far, could soon specialize in warships. Last summer, the federal government and the state of Lower Saxony helped the fabulously wealthy Meyer family dynasty out of their crisis with 400 million euros in support and guarantees of 2.8 billion euros. The aim was not so much to save thousands of endangered jobs, as Chancellor Olaf Scholz and the local branch of the German IG Metall announced, but to secure maritime military capacity. According to various reports, the Meyer shipyard, which includes the Neptune Werft in Rostock, could be converted into a large central naval shipyard. Experts assume that 5 frigates could be built there annually. Owners of capital and financial speculators expect huge business from the conversion of civilian industrial companies into armaments and weapons foundries. Just as ThyssenKrupp, Volkswagen, Daimler, and BMW once made their money from armaments during the Second World War, after having previously financed Hitler's rise to power, they are now once again betting on war and German great power politics. IG Metall and other trade union bureaucracies are supporting the corporations in this conversion to a war economy. They are, so to speak, standing to attention. Volkswagen's conversion to armaments ties in with the history as Hitler's model armaments factory. On the German television channel ZDF, VW and Porsche boss Oliver Blum said that there was a great deal of leeway, including in the direction of the armaments industry. He considered entry into arms production to be a possibility in view of the uncertain future of Volkswagen sites in Germany, Blum said. We are looking very specifically at what is necessary there. For example, it should also be about producing military vehicles. You have to check that out. End quote. Shortly before Christmas, the VW management, IG Metall, and Works Council had agreed to cut 35,000 jobs and reduce wages by 20%. Now, it is a matter of the concrete implementation of this. The assertions of management and IG Metall that no plant will be closed can now be seen for what they really are. On ZDF, Blum avoided talking about the closure of plants such as those in Osnabrück and Dresden, instead saying that there must be a large space for solutions. He said the company had a responsibility to take care of the future of the employees of the endangered plants. Exploratory talks are presumably already underway between VW, Rheinmetall, and government representatives. A Rheinmetall spokesperson emphasized that the conversion of the VW plant in Osnabrück would be associated with high cost and that such investments could only be made if secure orders were guaranteed by the government. The new federal government will very quickly set in motion such arms orders in order to implement the promised rearmament. Rheinmetall CEO Papperger emphasized that talks are regularly held with Volkswagen, not least because Rheinmetall and VW cooperate in the construction of trucks. On Wednesday, Rheinmetall also published its annual report, according to which group sales in 2024 rose by an incredible 36% to almost 10 billion euros. Particularly noteworthy is the fact that the production of weapons, tanks, and ammunition now accounts for 80% of the group's earnings. What is not well known to the public so far is that the Volkswagen Group is already producing military vehicles. Among other things, the Amarok M, a military version of the first generation of the VW pickup, is being produced together with Rheinmetall. And the VW subsidiary, MAN, supplies large numbers of base vehicles for the heavy Rheinmetall military trucks, which are also being used in the NATO war against Russia in Ukraine. And VW is even involved in tank production. Volkswagen subsidiary Renk, a gearbox manufacturer, supplies gearboxes not only for water and wind power plants, but also for warships and tanks, including the German Leopard and Puma tanks, the British Ajax, and the Turkish Altay. It is therefore becoming increasingly clear that the massive job cuts at VW and the freed up production capacities, including some of the labor force, are to be used for extensive war production. In this way, the VW Group is continuing its history as a Nazi state-owned enterprise. With the beginning of World War II in 1939, Volkswagen was fully converted to armaments production. In 1934, Adolf Hitler had announced the construction of a people's car at the International Motor Show in Berlin. Ferdinand Porsche, grandfather of Wolfgang Porsche, chairman of the supervisory board of Porsche Automobile Holding, and today a VW billionaire, was commissioned by the German Automobile Industry Association to construct this Volkswagen. In 1935, the German Labor Front, DAF, founded the Gesellschaft zur Wohlbereitung des Volkswagen, MBH, Company for the Preparation of the Volkswagen, and eventually organized the construction of the factory and specially created town, which is now called Wolfsburg. However, the Kraft durch Freudenwagen, KDF, power through joy car, was designed but never built, and production was switched to war. The KDF car was converted into a military amphibious vehicle and armored car. From then on, Volkswagen produced vast quantities of bazookas, anti-personnel mines, and parts for the Ju-88 airplane and V-1 rocket. The Nazi state-owned company worked closely with the SS, which provided unlimited access to forced labor, prisoners of war, and concentration camp inmates. Up to 20,000 forced laborers toiled in Wolfsburg until they were worn out or worked to death. From 1942, the company even set up its own concentration camp called Arbeitsdorf, Labor Town, on the factory premises. Many forced laborers also had to live in the disused washhouses of the number one factory hall. According to VW, around two-thirds of the workforce were forced laborers in 1944. It was only in 1986 that the Volkswagen company commissioned historian Hans Mommsen to investigate the company history, and it took another 10 years before his study was published. The murderous conditions of exploitation and the history of the former arms factory, which was involved in the war of extermination against the Soviet Union, did not fit into the narrative of post-war Germany's social market economy and social partnership with the trade unions. The situation of Soviet prisoners was particularly cruel, with many dying. Between 1940 and 1945 alone, 365 children and babies died, most of whom had been taken from forced laborers directly after birth. Forced laborers had to wait until 1998 for a few meager compensation payments. It was only 53 years after this forced labor that the filthy rich Porsche Piëch family, who hold a major stake in the company, set up a relief fund in hope that there were hardly any remaining survivors entitled to compensation. Today, Volkswagen workers are confronted with the return of VW's brutal past. You could find all this and more at the World Socialist website, wsws.org. This has been Archie Stone for the World Socialist website.
The World Socialist website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.